Hallo en welkom bij het Geldspoor. De podcast die gaat over kwesties die we op Follow the Money aan de kaak stellen. Mijn naam is Erik Smit en vandaag zit naast mij Roel Jansen. Financieel-economisch journalist en auteur van verschillende boeken, waaronder het onlangs bij Follow the Money verschenen boek Gokkers en Graaiers, financiële schandalen van de VOC tot de Zuidas. Verder weg van ons, aan de overkant van het kanaal, zit Oliver Ballo, Brits onderzoeksjournalist. Zijn artikelen verschenen onder andere in The Guardian, The New York Times en hij werkte eerder voor het persbureau Reuters. Bullo schreef meerdere boeken en behaalde internationaal succes met de publicatie van het boek Moneyland, Why Thieves and Crooks Now Rule the World and How to Take It Back. Vandaag spreken we hem over zijn nieuwste boek, Butler to the World, How Britain Helps the World's Worst People Launder Money, Commit Crimes and Get Away with Anything. Roel en ik zullen Oliver interviewen en omdat onze gast de Nederlandse taal niet machtig is, schakelen we over op het Engels. Hello, Roel. Hello, Oliver. Welcome. Looking at the titles of your last two books, Oliver, it's fair to say that you are a little concerned about people who seem to get away with financial crimes. Can you tell us what triggered your worries?
Yeah, so it's a slightly strange world that I ended up in. I started off with a passion for Russia. I moved to Russia as soon as I finished university, and I lived there for many years. And I suppose I didn't so much want to write about corruption. I wasn't interested in corruption. It was just that corruption was interested in me. I ended up, you know, being shaken down for bribes by police officers, you know, doctors, customs officials, whoever. And I became increasingly interested over the years of what was going on. You know, why are some countries corrupt and some countries not? And I suppose part of my concern was a feeling that when we talk about the world that way, that some countries are corrupt and some countries aren't, we're not really getting the full picture. And the main reason for that is that the corrupt people, the oligarchs, the kleptocrats, they tend to end up living or at the very least holidaying in countries that aren't corrupt. So, you know, Russian oligarchs end up in London, or, you know, West African oligarchs end up in Paris, or, you know, South American oligarchs end up in Miami. And yet we think of South America, West Africa and Russia as corrupt, and yet we don't think of Britain, France or the United States as corrupt. And the more I looked at this question, the more I became convinced that there was a international system which was essentially set up had come to exist to allow crooks and kleptocrats to get away with stealing everything that they wanted, and that this fact lay behind almost everything that's going wrong with the world. You know, terrorism, inequality, instability, war in Ukraine at the moment. All of this could at least partly be explained by our tolerance of corruption and our willingness to ignore the origin of wealth if that wealth is large enough. And so I started writing about that, and it turns out that it's an almost inexhaustible topic. I didn't really mean to write a second book at the moment. Actually, I'm researching a third book. I suppose I thought that, you know, once I'd written one, that would be enough. But it's the gift that keeps on giving, or rather whatever the opposite of that is.
We'll talk about the third book later. But you also showed how oligarchs and kleptocrats actually moved into what you say, non-corrupt countries like the UK. And they are usually visible in London, of course. And you're organizing your kleptocrat tours there. What do you show to your guests and the people who walk with you around in London?
Yeah, so the kleptocracy tours, I wish they'd been my idea. They were the idea of a friend of mine, Roman. We started doing them after the Ukrainian Revolution of 2014, when there was a lot of debate about corruption, but not really much understanding of where corrupt money ends up. And I think particularly a lot of people in London were unaware that corrupt officials, oligarchs, like to steal money in other countries and then bring it to the UK to enjoy it and to spend it and to protect it. So And the Kleptocracy Tour, the idea came from a Hollywood bus tour. You know, you put people in a bus in Hollywood and point out houses belonging to film stars. In London, we do that, except we don't point out film stars. We point out oligarchs and kleptocrats and, you know, other, you know, people who have become wealthy in questionable ways. So
do you do it by double decker or do you walk around?
No, we do it by single decker. I mean, it would be fun to do it by double decker. You do get those sort of sightseeing double decker buses, but they're quite a lot more expensive and we're all volunteers. So we have to kind of do it on the cheap. We're not, sadly, we have no oligarchs on our side. But yeah, we have, you know, houses belonging to, you know, Russian politicians, friends of Vladimir Putin's, Russian oligarchs, obviously, Ukrainian oligarchs, Kazakh oligarchs, Nigerians. I mean, you name it, you know, London is a target rich environment and we're only scratching the surface.
What are the most fantastic pieces of real estate you pass by? Can you give us some examples?
Well, I think everyone's got their favorite. My particular favorite is one that the story of which I tell in Butler to the World, which is a tube station. Brompton Road tube station, which became the property of a Ukrainian oligarch who became very wealthy working with Gazprom, Putin's gas company, and took his vast profits brought them to the UK and spent them on many things, including a tube station, which he bought from our government in 2014. It's the most remarkable demonstration of how everything is for sale in the UK, even, you know, what you would have thought of as a sort of strategic object, an object at the heart of our national security, like something with access to our, you know, the London Underground system. And it's particularly striking that just a couple of weeks after the sale was finalized and announced, he was indicted by the US, the FBI, on corruption charges. So he's never actually got to enjoy his tube station. He's been stuck in Vienna ever since, battling extradition. So though he bought the tube station back in 2014, nothing has ever happened with it. It's still sitting there in exactly the same way that it was back then. But it is a remarkable...
It's next to his mansion.
Yeah, so his mansion is one of those, you know, what people in London call iceberg houses, in that there's as much of them below the surface as there is above the surface. It cost him about £60 million. And it's, you know, I quite often look at these kind of kleptocrat mansions and think, God, not for me. But Mr. Firtash's house, it's pretty nice. I'd live there quite happily. It's in a lovely location, just near Harrods. It's got a swimming pool in the second basement. It's got, you know, lovely balconies, two elephant sculptures outside the front door. If any of your listeners ever want to go and have a look at it, it's just by Holy Trinity Brompton Church on a street called Cottage Place. I highly recommend going to have a look. It's very easy to get to.
Have thousands of people there watching, you know, that would certainly increase the price of the property, wouldn't it?
Well, I don't know. I don't think he appreciated our attention, or someone didn't appreciate our attention, because every time we used to turn up, they used to call the police. So the police officers would turn up and they'd always been told a different reason why it was bad that we were there, because it wasn't like we were just on the pavement. We weren't, you know, in his garden or anything. But the police would turn up and they'd always been told that in one particular occasion, which was particularly fun, they were under the impression that we were extreme Russian nationalists protesting against him because he was a Ukrainian patriot. And then the police got me, and I couldn't be less of an extreme Russian nationalist, really, if you ask. I'm just a very ordinary British person. So that was quite fun, but it was quite satisfying because the police would stay and listen to what we had to say. And I think they kind of came around to our point of view in the end, that perhaps we shouldn't be selling tube stations to this kind of person in the first place. So yeah, that's the Kleptocracy Tours. There, you know, it is a, We have one next month, actually, to mark the anniversary of this stage of the war in Ukraine, and to try and lay out why the British government hasn't done nearly enough, despite its claims to have done so, to crack down on corrupt Russian
wealth. That was my question, actually. Does the British government seize property like that? I mean, what happens with it?
No. The tube station is still unseized. Mr. Firtash's legal troubles that he has are entirely a result of the actions of the American authorities, not the British authorities. Since the this latest stage of the war in Ukraine, since last February, obviously, like in the European Union, many Russian oligarchs have had their property sanctioned in the UK. So it's been frozen. They can't do anything with it, but it hasn't been confiscated. And there haven't really been any, in fact, there haven't been any criminal investigations into the origin of their wealth. What investigations there has been into attempts to evade the sanctions. So even though the British government has been saying that, you know, since February 24th last year, it's been doing a huge amount to crack down on Russian oligarchs, it hasn't actually really done anything at all. It's just sanctioned their wealth and will continue to sanction it until it decides to unsanction it.
Well, it shows how very welcome the British are for their guests, I would say. I mean, the title of your book, The Butler of the World, you know, draws attention to this, obviously.
We're a very hospitable nation, provided that you can afford our services. We're not very hospitable to people who can't afford our services. But if you're rich enough, then we roll out the red carpet and we'll provide you with absolutely anything that you require. Yes.
Of course, that's why your book is called Butler of the World, because it's not, you know, like an ordinary person like Ruul Jansen, for instance, couldn't afford himself
or Eric Schmidt,
for instance, couldn't afford himself a butler. Can you tell us something more about the metaphor butler?
Yeah, so this came about in a conversation that I had with an American academic, actually. And he'd come over to the UK to investigate money laundering, and he... Basically, the reason he wanted to talk to me was he wanted to be put in touch with other people to talk to. He didn't particularly want to talk to me, but he had heard about the kleptocracy tours and everything. So he knew this is an issue I'm interested in. And he was hoping that I would introduce him to, you know, politicians, law enforcement officers, so on, people who could tell him what was going on with money laundering in the UK. And I had this very depressing conversation with him in which he would ask me, you know, who in Britain was doing the equivalent of, you know, whatever agency in the US he would name, the FBI or the Department of Justice or Homeland Security investigations or whatever. And I would have to tell him that we have no equivalent in the UK, that no one's doing that work. And he was finding this quite hard to believe. I think he felt that I was holding out on him and I just not sharing my contacts. And so eventually I just to try and explain what was happening, saying, no, you have to understand that, you know, in America, you investigate oligarchs, you investigate criminals because you see yourselves as policemen to the world. But in Britain, we're not like that. You know, and I wanted to say, well, if, you know, America's policemen to the world, you know, what are we? You know, what's our equivalent? And the vision I had in my head was a bit like, you know, a consigliere in a mafia movie, you know, the guy who helps the Don to get away with stuff, who helps him with his crimes. But that's not a British stereotype, you know, that doesn't work. So, you know, what's our equivalent? And it suddenly occurred to me that a butler was the thing, you know, someone who beautifully dressed, you know, good manners, very polite and all that, but totally amoral. You know, if their employer wants them to help them commit a crime, they'll do it to the best of their abilities. If they want to help them hide their money, they'll do it to the best of their abilities. And that's what Britain does. You know, if someone comes and can afford the services of, well, specifically London, to be honest, if they can afford the services of London, then London will provide those services and will be the best that there is when it comes to hiding money, you know, moving money, investing money, spending money, all of the things that a person with money would want.
To understand butlerism, you actually went to a butler school, didn't you?
yeah, that was early days. You know, I'd had this idea of this metaphor, and it's actually, it isn't just a metaphor. Britain doesn't just provide metaphorical butlers who, you know, lawyers and accountants who serve the needs of their clients. It also provides many actual butlers. You know, butlers, though you might think of them as the kind of thing that only belongs in, you know, a movie from the 1930s, you know, they're still a thing, and they're very popular among, you know, people able to afford them. And there are schools in the UK which train butlers for oligarchs so they can go and, you know, be a butler on a yacht or in a mansion or in a ski resort and behave impeccably and do all the right things. You know, these aren't skills that everyone has. You need to learn them. So I went to a butler school. I learned flower arranging for a morning. I was quite good at it, actually. I quite enjoyed it. But I think the butler school, you know, they're not stupid. And I think they Googled me and realized quite quickly that I wasn't actually very interested in being a butler since I write about financial crime. So I only got to go for a morning. But it was still very interesting to have that morning, not least because I was chatting to one of my fellow trainees, a Canadian woman. And I asked, you know, what's this butler thing all about? You know, why does everyone want butlers? And her reply was very good. She was like, well, don't you understand? You know, everyone wants their own Jeeves. And, you know, I don't know
Jeeves
how...
Jeeves from P.G. Woodhouse, you mean?
Jeeves from P.D. Woodhouse, the Jeeves and Worcester stories, which, I mean, I don't think they're quite as popular outside the UK as they are here, but they, you know, they're relatively well known. You know, and, you know, Bertie Wooster is an idiot with a lot of money who's always getting into trouble. And, you know, Reginald Jeeves is his butler or his valet who always gets him out of trouble. And he's, you know, this incredibly intelligent man, like totally, I mean, capable of anything. He can achieve anything. He knows everyone. He can do anything. And yet he dedicates his skills and his and all his talents to helping his employer get away with the various nonsense that his employer gets stuck into. And so in the absence of having any actual butlers to talk to, I dedicated myself to, during lockdown, to reading all of the P.G. Woodhouse stories. And the amazing thing is that, you know, you have this idea that Jeeves is this rather cuddly, friendly man who's just so funny and you know, sorts out all the problems. He's a real rogue. He's a bad guy. If you look at some of the crimes he helps Bertie Wooster get away with, they're quite remarkable. And this, and you know, the tools he uses, he bribes a police officer, he assaults a police officer, he interferes with court proceedings, you know, he drugs a fellow valet in order to steal inside information. He's a right bad egg. And it struck me that he was a really perfect parallel for what Britain gets up to, because, you know, Britain, you know, the kind of international image of the UK is all sort of Harry Potter and, you know, the royal family and, you know, all that kind of stuff.
Well, they're in trouble as well right now.
Yeah, well, yeah, they're in, well, yeah, well, right. Maybe it's all falling down at once, you know.
You didn't only follow a course of butlerism as part of your research, but how did you do your other research for this book? How did you research all the schemes you describe, or all the persons you describe and the things they've been doing in order to make Britain actually this butler to the world?
Yeah, because you did it, like you said, in time of the lockdowns, which is particularly difficult to be active as a journalist, I suppose.
Well, I mean, one of the things that made it easy was the fact that, you know, I've been writing about financial crime for quite a long time, and there is always a British role in almost any financial crime you name, whether it's a British lawyer or a British shell company or a British accountant or a British politician or whatever. And I already had all those details, you know, on file. So I kind of knew where to look. And I managed to get some traveling done before lockdown happened. So I had a really interesting trip to the British Virgin Islands, which I'm sure I don't need to tell you is, you know, one of the most notorious tax havens in the world. And I had a fascinating time there meeting the architects of the British Virgin Islands, the people who created it and turned it into what it is. And I had a very interesting trip just before lockdown to Gibraltar, less well known as a tax haven, but in some ways as important as the place that totally revolutionized the gambling industry and made gambling, you know, as sort of prevalent and all pervasive as it is now. But then, yes, lockdown happened, which was annoying initially. It meant that a lot of the trips I wanted to do, I wasn't able to do. But actually, in the long term, I think it was not as bad journalistically as I thought it would be, because it forced me to really dig into British-based scams, which I probably would not have had time or the inclination to really spend the time investigating. One of the most amazing was the story of the Scottish Limited Partnership, one of the most obscure shell companies that there is, and the story of why the British government failed to do anything about it, even after it was revealed that Scottish Limited Partnerships were being used to...
Can you explain why there is so little political interest in closing loopholes like the Scottish private partnership? Or you also describe this historic anomaly that the Church of England is the supervisor of notaries in the UK. How is it possible that exists ever since the time of Thomas Cromwell, which is five centuries
ago?
Yeah,
so there is a tension at the heart of everything that the UK does. It's like the UK has two policies. One policy is that it supports democracy and freedom and all the good things. And the other policy is that it makes a living from selling services to the people who are the enemies of democracy and freedom. So it likes to think it supports the good things, but it makes a living from supporting the bad things. And there is a really difficult tension to reconcile at the heart of that, in that, you know, no one really wants to admit it to themselves that that's what's going on. So they just keep glossing over the problems. So the Scottish Limited Partnership, well, it's not something anyone designed. It happened kind of by accident, like many things in Britain. And for a century, no one really knew anything about them. They were just used in Scotland to a small extent by farmers to regulate their affairs.
Yes, and landowners. Yes.
And landowners, exactly. But like in a tiny numbers. But then some clever money launderers realized that these structures are absolutely perfect for moving money anonymously because, you know, they look legitimate, but they are totally anonymous, just like the best shell company from a tax haven. And so they very enthusiastically use them in vast numbers to move colossal amounts of money, you know, tens of billions, possibly hundreds of billions of euros out of mainly the former Soviet Union, hidden in Scottish Limited Partnerships.
And nobody simply paid attention to it. There was this single Scottish parliamentarian you mentioned, and then he didn't get anywhere.
Yeah, so Roger Mullin, bless him, tried very hard, but he was quite new to Parliament. He was maybe a bit naive, didn't realise how things work, which is that you're not supposed to make a fuss about these things, because if you do, you end up offending the wrong people. Because it turned out that it wasn't only money launderers who were enjoying the use of Scottish Limited Partnerships, it was also the big fund managers who also loved them for exactly the same reasons. Yeah, they also like anonymity and no taxes, just like money launderers do. So essentially, you know, because of Roger Mullin, this parliamentarian, he forced the government to make a choice, which was, did it support, you know, ending kleptocracy in Moldova and Russia, or did it support fund managers? And when it came down to it supported fund managers, and that was that.
Is that because the lobby is so strong, or is it the money that flows through parliament as well?
It's a bit of both, but mainly it's because Moldova and the victims of corruption everywhere have a very weak lobby in the UK, but fund managers have a very strong lobby. And that's the way it has always been. So it was a particularly stark example of the failure of Britain to care about the consequences of its actions and instead to prioritise the profits that it can make from moving money around rather than asking where that money came from in the first place. So that was, particularly gross.
You noticed that the Scottish Member of Parliament was a little bit naive and didn't really know how things were actually how they worked and that they had a certain tradition. And a lot of the British traditions, you know, are taught at elite schools, and you know, or perception here on the continent, you know, that's a long way from Britain, of course, is that the British are very well mannered and have, you know, highly educated and have a very decent and people with high morals. In the end, it seems all very different, you know, and that's also the interesting parallel with the butler, who is very well mannered, very highly educated, or at least, you know, knows how to cite poets and writers, but in the end is able to do any immoral action. So the British education system, can you tell us something about it? How does your elite has been educated and over all these years? And
yeah, it's actually one of the bits of the book that I was sorry not to be able to do as well as I wanted because of lockdown. I wanted to write more about the British education system because so much of the book is about the legacy of the British Empire, about institutions of the British Empire, which have been repurposed to serve not the elite of the British Empire anymore, but the elite of anyone who can afford our services. And this is exactly the case with, you know, the British elite school system, the private schools, which were in the main created to educate people so they could go and, you know, administer India or Sudan or Kenya or wherever. But now do a very good business education, the children of oligarchs from China or Russia or wherever. And the most remarkable example of this, for me, was the opening of a branch of an English private school in Egypt. It was Egyptian nationalism which really doomed the British Empire. The Suez Crisis.
The Suez Crisis of 1956.
Exactly, which humiliated the British Empire and showed that it was no longer a force to be reckoned with. And yet our butlers have been so successful in selling the vision of Britishness as something that everyone should aspire to, that now the grandchildren of those politicians who managed to drive out the British Empire are being educated at an English private school in Egypt. In fact, you know, Tony Blair, the former prime minister, went out to the opening ceremony of the school when it opened. And you get similar schools in China, you know, again, a country that was looted by the British Empire. And yet now there are English private schools all across China. You get them across places like Kazakhstan, all across Thailand. It's extraordinary the extent to which the English private school system has become the elite school system for the entire world.
We have them here in Amsterdam too, yeah, in the Netherlands, several. Yeah.
Well, it is, yeah, I mean, it's, you know, look, they're good schools, don't get me wrong. You know, they educate people well and they have good facilities, but they also have within them a kind of elitism, an implicit elitism that teaches people that they are better than other people in a way that is, in the long term, I think very harmful. You know, as I'm sure you are aware, you know, Britain has a very deeply entrenched class system, which has caused all kinds of problems. It's the kind of reason why someone like Boris Johnson became prime minister, despite being totally unsuited for the job, just because he talks and sounds like someone who should be in charge. And that is not really something
they learn at school.
Yeah, exactly. You learn that at school. And I don't really know if the rest of the world, you know, is ready to have that exported to them. You know, you end up with politicians like Boris Johnson, you know, I worry that that will be our fault. And I apologize in advance. I mean, it's just an example of the sort of the manners of the British butler class. I received an email yesterday from a friend of mine who is a lawyer. And he's discovered he's currently bringing a case against some journalists on behalf of a wealthy client. And he's discovered that I'm actually now in the case because I work with those journalists. And he sent me an email to essentially say, oh, by the way, I wanted you to find out from me that I'm bringing this case against you, or that you're involved in this case that I'm bringing. And, you know, it was very polite that he sent me this email and very, I suppose, very nice of him to send me the email. But it would be nicer if he hadn't done it in the first place. And so that's a lot of how, you know, butler Britain behaves. You know, it's doing things that are essentially harmful, but doing them very politely, you know, and that's the Jeeves model. You know, you're impeccably dressed, you're well-spoken.
But how do you explain the complete lack of moral leadership from let's say, the leaders that come from your
educational system?
It's amazing, isn't it? You know, and I think, you know, there are, it's not to say everyone's bad. There are good people who come out of those schools and do good things. But look, there's a lot of money to be made from being a butler. I think that people are very good at justifying their actions to themselves if those actions are going to make them a lot of money. You know, butlering has been a profitable business model for a significant proportion of you know, the UK for decades now. And, you know, and they have told themselves that it's an acceptable way to make a living. And that's a very convenient thing for them to be told.
Is it opportunism, or is it simply leniency or amorality or greed for money?
Well, it is greed, obviously, but it's important to understand that this was never designed. No one ever created this system. No, it's not like there's a, you know, a genius who sat back one day and said, I know, I'm going to create a new model in Britain whereby we launder money for the world's kleptocrats and protect the reputations of the world's worst people, you know, and educate their children. It's happened gradually over many years. And I suppose that if someone came from the 1950s and looked at the situation now, they might say, that's appalling. But the fact that it's happened gradually has allowed, you know, it to be a series of very small steps, which are...
What I find very interesting in your book, you give an example of those small steps by single persons who managed to turn a country like the BVI or Gibraltar or the Cayman Islands into money laundering centers. You describe the story of Michael Regal, so the BVI, of Victor Chandler of Gibraltar, and Milton Grandy in the Cayman Islands, and they have actually invented the whole idea of shell companies, of trusts and hedge funds being legally protected in those territories. Was this just smart guys, or was it the system itself that they made use of?
I mean, you know, I think in the UK we have a system that is unusually flexible, and unusually willing to countenance these kind of innovations. But it's helped by the fact that, you know, Britain is not one thing. You know, there's the United Kingdom, but there's also all these little bits of Britain, whether that's Jersey, Guernsey, the Isle of Man, Gibraltar, the British Virgin Islands, the Cayman Islands, Bermuda, all these leftover bits from the British Empire scattered all around the world. And they have the laws which are the same as Britain, and also the ability to change those laws and to make them more convenient for, you know, wealthy clients, if those wealthy clients want them to be. So it's a very convenient setup for wealthy clients of Britain, that they can use one bit of Britain against another bit. And this is what happened with gambling in Gibraltar, which is the most amazing story, which I discovered completely by accident. I'd actually gone to Gibraltar to write about something else. And I just suddenly came across this issue with gambling, and it was amazing and so fascinating to me that...
You didn't know it was a gambling rock of the world.
No, I mean, and if you go there, you wouldn't know. That's the extraordinary thing about it, because although it does have, it has a casino on a boat, and it has like two betting shops, just like the ones you get on the street in the UK, there is no way of knowing that all of these office buildings are full of people running some of the world's biggest gambling companies. And that this sort of offshore gambling that you get all over the EU and elsewhere in the world is run out of Gibraltar. This is a, you know, you wouldn't know that. There's no way of telling. But the impact that that has had on, you know, the rates of gambling addiction in the UK, in the EU and elsewhere have been absolutely catastrophic. And it's, you know, been very prosperous for Gibraltar. Gibraltar's done very well out of it, but it's been much more prosperous for the people who own gambling companies. You know, they've done incredibly well, and it's allowed them to, you know, essentially evade having to pay any kind of, you know, any kind of sum back to society, the societies they've been taking all this money out of. That was only possible because Gibraltar, though it's British, is also not British. You know, I'd appreciate, I mean, there's a slightly similar situation in the Netherlands with, you know, places like the Curaçao and so on. So I'm sure this is a...
Curaçao has a huge online gambling industry as well. I understood there are over 100,000 gambling sites are registered or located in Curaçao.
Yeah, and you know, and Curaçao has had a role similar to the British Virgin Islands as a place for shell companies and so on over the years. So I'm sure that, I mean, this is a picture that people in the Netherlands will be, you know, very familiar with.
I found it interesting you mentioned that they choose for the British Virgin Island because they're speaking English and there's not enough English being spoken in Curaçao, nor the laws and everything else, of course.
Well, I mean, right, you know, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, you know, Dutch people, you know, I'm always amazed by how beautifully Dutch people speak English, but, you know, obviously court documents are in Dutch and so on. So the great advantage the British Virgin Islands had over Curaçao was you didn't need to hire translators, which meant it's cheaper.
Well, there you go. I mean, this is all about competition between countries competing with their systems. And you described it actually in your book, how after the Second World War and especially after the humiliation of the Suez Crisis, Great Britain had to basically reinvent itself and reinvent its business model, not anymore able to go to its overseas territories, etc. They were all taken away from them. So they started to think to become a financial capital of the world, that is the city, of course, and then become fiercely entrenched in this battle with New York to become that capital of the world. And after that, obviously, many more battles were fought. But is this something that's where basically the race to the bottom all started?
Yeah, I mean, it's the important thing to understand is that the money doesn't care where it is, right? Money is happy to go anywhere. And so Britain's sort of strategic goal has been to be the place that treats the money best. So the money ends up here. Because if you treat the money well, a bit of the money sticks around and you get to, you know, earn some fees out of it. And so as a result, there's this sort of cluster of services have grown up in the UK, which are, I think, unrivaled anywhere. In that there are other places that can hide money, and there are other places that can invest money. There are other places that can educate the children of people with money, and there are other places that will sell art to people with money. But there isn't anywhere that can do all of those things as well as Britain can do all at once. You know, London is a one-stop shop for oligarchs in a way that nowhere else on earth is. You can come to fly your private jet into London. It has a very understanding legal system and, you know, a language that everyone speaks, very accommodating politicians, you know, houses that anyone can buy, you know, shops that sell you anything. It's an incredibly easy place to be very rich. And, you know, that has led to, you know, a whole sort of section of British society being dependent on the maintenance of that system. So it's very difficult now to do something about. You know, if you try to push back against butlering as a business model, you know, you do end up with, you know, a lot of people criticizing you for, you know, talking Britain down or trying to make us uncompetitive or whatever. We saw a lot of this around the Brexit debate. You know, in during the Brexit debate, there was this kind of obsession among certain people on the Leave side of turning Britain into what they called Singapore on Thames, you know, by which I don't think they meant having a very good social housing sector. What they meant was having far less regulation for money and industry so that more money, even more money, would come to London. You know, what
would
that
means. Say that Brexit has given a new impetus to this whole attitude of Britain?
Well, I think that the thing that saved us so far from that happening is the incompetence of the politicians, to be honest. I mean, if the people who'd won the Brexit vote and came to government had been less incompetent, they might have been able to transform Britain in genuinely alarming and disturbing ways. But as it is, they've just been incredibly bad at achieving anything, which is lucky, really. So, you know, hopefully that will remain so and they never get a chance to transform Britain in the way they want to. Because, you know, when people talk about, you know, removing red tape, you know, what they're talking about is removing, you know, workers' rights, about removing, you know, people's holiday rights, people's, you know, sick pay rights or you know, getting rid of healthcare and things. It's, you know, it's easy to talk about removing red tape, but all of those, you know, red tape, all those regulations, they exist for a reason. And so I remain concerned that Brexit will allow certain politicians to transform Britain into even more of a butler than it already is. But so far, it is lucky that the politicians who have come to power since the referendum have all been so utterly useless, because it has meant that, sure, that hasn't actually really happened yet.
London has been rightly dubbed Londongrad because of the inflow of so many Russian oligarchs and everything. Turning to Russia, you mentioned, you started talking about that in the beginning of our talk as well. Does the war in Ukraine, has it made any difference in the attitude of Britain, or particularly the city and the butlers and what have you, towards the Russian oligarchs in the UK? Has anything been done about that? Is there a shift of attitude, a shift of being so welcome to them? And are they now being sanctioned strongly?
Yeah, I mean, the war in Ukraine has really exposed the sort of hypocritical nature of British foreign policy for a long time. This, you know, the fact that we're, you know, with one hand helping Ukraine to build a democratic society and with the other hand accepting the money of people who are destroying that democratic society, you know, has been starkly exposed by what's been happening in Ukraine. And I think as a result of the, you know, public anger over the outrage of what's been happening in Ukraine, there is, you know, a degree of political willingness to take a tough line against Russian oligarchs that there has not previously been. And also a sort of almost a self-sanctioning process whereby lawyers and accountants and so on have just decided not to have Russian oligarchs as their clients. And that's good. You know, it is good that those oligarchs are no longer so welcome here and that they have to go and, you know, spend their money in Dubai or wherever instead of here. But what the Londongrad word always sort of misunderstood is that we aren't just welcoming oligarchs from Russia into London. We welcome oligarchs from absolutely everywhere. The kleptocracy tours don't only feature Russians, they feature, you know, Nigerians, Malaysians, you know, Venezuelans, Kazakhs, you know, you name it, we have it. So all of those other oligarchs are just as welcome here as they always have been. In fact, probably more so. you know, a former minister in the Egyptian government has just become treasurer of the Conservative Party. You know, that is a remarkable thing to happen in any country, particularly in the circumstances of a time when we're supposedly taking, you know, kleptocracy seriously.
Isn't there a younger generation that comes up now and sees this happening in the midst of this war, and also because of journalists like you, you know, putting the finger on that type of hypocrisy? Do you see something emerging?
I'm hopeful that the, I mean, look, this isn't a party political issue. There are people on both sides of the house who are appalled by kleptocracy, and I wouldn't want, you know, to suggest that this is only a Conservative Party problem and that everyone else is great. You know, that isn't the case. When there was a Labour government, it was just as bad at allowing dirty money into the UK as the Conservatives are. However, the Labour Party does have some good ideas now, and I would like to see them have a chance to adopt those, to take financial crime more seriously, to prosecute it properly, to have proper transparency in ownership of you know, property and companies and so on, in a way that we don't currently have. But there is so much to do. You know, the
but it's not particular like younger people are opposing it. I mean, are frightened or at least, you know, shocked by this business model of their country.
I think younger people are opposed to it, but it's not anyone's priority. Right. You know, this is part of the problem, is that, you know, the victims of what's happening are far away, and everyone's got a bigger problem at home to face. So the challenge I always face is trying to find ways of telling the story and explaining why this is a problem, not just in Malaysia or Ukraine or Venezuela, but is also a problem here in the UK. Why should we care?
Do you find young audiences?
Yeah. I mean, I've generally, one of the amazing things about Butler to the World is the fact that it has been well received by everyone. Not just, I suppose I was worried that because there's a lot of debate at the moment around the legacy of the British Empire, and that tends to be, you know, on the left of politics, people criticize the British Empire, people on the right of politics defend it, you know, and that is a topic by which people like shouting at each other on Twitter about. So I suppose I was concerned that this book might be read as part of that debate and that people on the right of politics might criticize me for it. But look, I you know, the book was published last year in the UK, and it was a book of the year in both the Daily Mail, which is the most prominent right-wing newspaper in the UK, and also in the Socialist Worker, and also in The Economist. So, you know, I think that covers the spectrum pretty well, you know, from, you know, left, right, and middle. Everyone's received it well. Everyone recognizes that being a butler is a bad thing. It's just trying to persuade the butlers, or find a way to persuade them, to stop doing it. That's the challenge that politicians now face, and I'm going to keep banging on about it until they achieve it.
That's quite remarkable, by the way. Do you think that the sanctions that Britain has applied to Russian oligarchs, or Russian money, kleptocracy in the UK, has it been sufficient, or could more have been done, or what is your opinion about it, what the government has been doing?
I mean, the sanctions are quite good, actually. You know, they've been quite broad, lots of people covered.
And
I mean,
are they working?
Well, that's the important question, because we don't really know what working means. Right. What does that mean when you say, are they working? Because what I would like to see is sanctions as a, you know, as a law enforcement tool, right? You have, you know, a whole industry of investigations and prosecutions and constantly going on all the time. And then sanctions are the cherry on that cake, right? They're very top of that particular argument. So you say, you know, if it's like in a spaceship, when you have a button on the dashboard that you press when you need to go really fast, you know, normally it's a spaceship, it goes pretty fast anyway, but sometimes you've got to go that bit faster and you press the button on the dashboard and zoom, off you go into space. That's what sanctions should be. Just at the moment, sanctions are all of the cake. There isn't anything else going with it. You know, and I don't think that's only a British problem. I think that that's also a problem across the EU, actually. You know, that we're all really struggling to investigate and prosecute financial crime. And partly that's a problem that there's a lack of cooperation between countries. It's easy to hide your money between different countries. But Britain is particularly bad. And what I think we need to do now is to take the opportunity of this wealth having been frozen, all these houses having been frozen, these shares having been frozen and so on, and then investigate them, investigate where the wealth came from, and if it's criminal, to confiscate it.
Has anything been confiscated up till now?
No, nothing has been confiscated. And I would be surprised if anything was confiscated, to be honest. There is a criminal investigation into one Russian oligarch, Pyotr Avin, I think it is. Though I'm not sure that's been confirmed by the authorities, but that's what's been written about in the press.
Friedman was recently...
Yes, you're right. Not Pyotr Avin, I mean Michael Friedman, his business partner.
Michael
you're right.
Friedman.
Yeah, yeah, sorry.
But what happened to him, do you know? Because all his companies registered legally in the Netherlands.
Yeah, so, I mean, that's still ongoing. Friedman, not Avin. The investigation is into...
They're partners, by the way.
Yes, exactly. Easy mistake to make. The investigation is to... allegations of trying to evade sanctions, so that the investigation is to his actions since he was sanctioned, not his actions before he was sanctioned. As far as I know, there are no investigations ongoing into his actions beforehand. So no, I mean, nothing's happened at the moment. It's just going on. But the problem is that, unlike in particularly the United States and to a certain extent in places like Spain and Italy, the agencies tasked with investigating financial crime are very small, very underfunded.
Underfunded and undercapitalized as far as personnel is concerned.
Absolutely. You know, if you know, people who work for them are paid very poorly. And so inevitably, after 2 or 3 years, you know, they've learned the job and they can go and work in the compliance department of a bank, you know, double their salary and half their stress. So why wouldn't you do it? You know, and that is an ongoing problem. You know, if I were in charge, if there was the Oliver Bullo-ocracy, briefly, I would, you know, massively increase funding for law enforcement looking into financial crime. Because, you know, as examples we've seen, you know, from the United States and elsewhere, it can pay for itself prosecuting financial crime. If you bring these cases...
There's a business model in there, you mean?
Yeah, exactly. You can levy very large fines.
Seize properties.
Seize property. And so you don't only improve society and return assets to victims, but you can also, you know, it can be a self-funding model with very large fines.
Wonderful idea.
Well, exactly. And I mean, it requires a degree of investment to get it going for a few years, but once it's going, then it's self-sustaining. And I don't understand why more governments don't do that. Actually tried to make this case to the Scottish government not long ago.
Similar in the Netherlands as well. It's underfunded and understaffed.
Yeah, though the Netherlands has been making some interesting progress, I think, in terms of, you know, private-public cooperation with sharing data and information among... I think the Netherlands is doing pretty well, actually, you know, compared to the competition, which is, you know, the UK, where everything's pretty bad.
But let's speak about it a little bit, you know, because the Netherlands, you know, is trying to also be a butler.
Yeah.
Except we are not well...
Servant.
Yeah, because we're not well-mannered and we don't have those nice public schools and we're foul-mouthed and everything. So we have, you know, we have a bit of a, you know, we're lagging behind, you know. It's hard to compete with the British, of course, but still we tried hard and we're pretty good at it. What do you advise us to, you know, if Bulloism would come to the Netherlands, would you also advise us to increase more on?
I mean, the challenge that we all face, of course, in Europe, in which I include Britain, because geographically we're still in Europe, even though we've self-exiled ourselves, is... that we all need to work much more closely together. You know, it's so easy for oligarchs to create a sort of a pile of shell companies in Cyprus, in the UK, in Luxembourg, in the Netherlands, and essentially make it impossible to figure out who owns what or to investigate what's happening in a way that's totally crazy because... you know, there's a single market. The money moves seamlessly across the EU. People move seamlessly across the EU. And yet somehow these laws persist, making it hard for police officers to track the movement of that money. So, you know, if we're going to have a single market for wealth, there also needs to be a single market for law enforcement. That seems totally obvious to me.
That's your story from Moneyland.
Well, I mean, absolutely. And you know, and it's an issue that hasn't been solved. In fact, thanks to the ruling from the European Court of Justice last year about, you know, the right to privacy in company ownership in Luxembourg, it's actually got worse in the last few months. You know, it is, you know, once again, corporate registries across Europe are closed. And you can't just figure out who owns what. You know, and I think that, you know, we have created a form of globalization that is very beneficial to the owners of wealth. And it is time to either make globalization equally beneficial for people who would investigate the sources of that wealth, or else to make life a little bit harder for the owners of wealth. You know, it is, we've got stuck in a kind of weird half globalization where it's all good for rich people, but not good for the rest of us. And that is a real problem. You know, so more cooperation between countries is the answer, you know.
What will be your role in this more cooperation? What are your next projects? What will you be doing next? What will be the third book?
So I've become very interested in money laundering, by which I mean, you know, criminal money laundering. You know, the world has been fighting money laundering since the late 1980s. The Financial Action Task Force was created in the late 1980s. There were various treaties, the Vienna and Palermo in the late 80s, early 90s, you know, and all of these architecture of compliance and you know, the AML industry was created in the late 80s and early 90s.
Anti-money laundering.
Yeah, the anti-money laundering industrial complex. But what's really interesting about it is if you look at estimates of how much money was laundered in the late 80s and estimates of how much money is being laundered now, the estimates then were 2 to 5% of global GDP. The estimates now are 2 to 5% of global GDP. So we've spent tens of billions, hundreds of billions of euros investigating, stopping money laundering, and have totally failed to stop money laundering. We haven't even made a dent in it. So what on earth is going on? Why is that happening?
And that will be the topic of your next book?
Yeah, it's really interesting. It's amazing, really. Yeah.
And we should cooperate.
Yeah, and I mean, it's so fun. And, well, fun, I mean, it's not. It's incredibly depressing and awful. But it's, I think that the, well, I mean, I, you know, it's fascinating and depressing and dispiriting. But what's amazing about it is the extent to which everyone, I think, who works in money laundering knows this is true. I say this to people, you know, and I had this at the beginning when I first started writing about corruption and the laundering of money and the way money was moved out of countries like Russia and spent in places like the UK. And I would say to, you know, law enforcement officers, you know, what I thought, and they would just go, yeah, that's right, yeah. And I'd just be amazed. It's like, but why is no one stopping this? You know.
And no, but you write it yourself. Yeah, no one has an interest in it.
Exactly. And yet, you know, in terms of money laundering, this is the support industry for the, you know, for the looting of the world, for, you know, the sort of despoliation of Africa, for this epidemic of fraud, which is affecting the most vulnerable people in our societies. This is the support industry for it. And it's happening everywhere all the time. And everyone's pretending to do something about it and failing to do so. And so that's going to be the subject of my next book. And, I, you know, I'm just getting started on trying to find the stories that will allow me to tell it. But it's kind of amazing and quite fun.
In the end, I mean, you're going to shed more light on all the subjects. And but do you see a light in the end of the tunnel as well? I mean, it's incredibly depressing. But I mean, is there a way out? Of course, you mentioned, you know, the cooperation international. But do you actually see it happening?
So I actually try and look at the question slightly differently to that. The problem, whether it's global money laundering or Britain being a butler or the Netherlands being you know, whatever the Dutch equivalent of a butler
little
is.
I mean,
quite big, but I'm just not sure that the Netherlands had butlers. You're too egalitarian for that. I think you have, you know, whatever the Dutch equivalent of a butler is.
Don't be fooled.
But
we're the largest transit country of money.
Yeah, well, I know, absolutely. But all I mean is that you don't have the stereotype of the butler, right? You have a, you know, whatever the Dutch equivalent is. But the problem is so vast that trying to stop it and solve it is it's like trying to take a bite out of a watermelon. It's too big. You can't get your teeth into it. So I have a friend in Ukraine called Daria Kalinyuk, who is one of the bravest and best anti-corruption activists in the world. And I'm a huge admirer of her. And she co-founded an organization called the Anti-Corruption Action Center, which, if you don't know, I highly recommend you check it out. They're extraordinary. But I once asked her how she didn't get depressed trying to tackle Ukrainian corruption, which is, you know, a vast problem. And she said that she doesn't think about it like that. She says that at the moment, Ukraine is at 4% of where she wants it to be. And her ambition is to get to 5. You know, she doesn't think about 100. She thinks about getting from 4 to 5. And if she gets to 5, then she'll think about 6. And so I suppose I try and think about it like that. You know, I don't think about the problem as a watermelon that you can't get your teeth into. Think about it as a big pile of grapes, and each one you can manage. So that's the challenge. Just trying to identify little individual things that you can impact, and things that you can try and change. And then the world is a bit less depressing, because otherwise it does get you down a bit.
Thank you very much for your time and for this interview.
Thank you.
It's my pleasure.
Oliver Ballow, of course. With his newest book, Butler to the World, How Britain Helps the World's Worst People Launder Money, Commit Crimes and Get Away with Anything. Read it.
In Dutch translation by the end of January.
Yes, it will. I look forward to seeing it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Yes. Pleasure.